At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Federal Reserve isn't usually in the business of setting records, but today it did. A record low benchmark interest rate. Great news for borrowers, assuming it frees up some credit. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation, seeking to increase American understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday. It is the 16th of December. Today, the Fed lowered the benchmark federal funds rate to a mere quarter of a percentage point. Lowest it's ever been. Ever. It's an effort to stem all kinds of problems, from a worsening recession to a big drop in retail prices. Marketplace's Bob Moon is here with us. And Bob, this is quite the bold move.
Indeed. The Fed cut more than many on Wall Street were expecting, deeper by a quarter percent. And the financial markets reacted in various ways. The stock market surged, but the Fed pulled the rug out from under some investors who had been figuring on a smaller rate cut. So some people rushed to buy up Treasury notes in anticipation that the Fed will keep pushing rates lower. And that had the effect of driving the yields on T-bills to historical lows.
Okay. Well, how much lower can interest rates really go?
Well, you can't get much lower than a quarter percent. So the Fed at this point has to start turning to some unconventional tactics to drive interest rates even lower. We heard from the Fed today this vow to use all available tools to deal with this stubborn crisis. Well, that could mean the Fed could start buying up Treasury notes, and that would push T-note prices up, effectively pushing interest rates even lower by forcing those yields on government bonds lower. The value of the dollar, by the way, also took a hit today in anticipation that it might not offer as high a return.
Why is the Fed feeling like it has to take such drastic action?
Well, the Fed sent a strong message today that it intends to keep these interest rates extremely low. And there's one line of thought, Tess, that the banks have kept a lot of their money on deposit in the Federal Reserve's vaults because they could actually earn a little more doing that than lending the money to each other. So now, if the banks can't get as much by letting that money sit, they might be prodded into lending again to businesses, to us, if only to get a better return by having to invest it out there in the marketplace.
Well, let me ask you about another figure out today, the Consumer Price Index. This is what we pay at the checkout counter. And prices actually going down right now. So this part of the Fed action as well?
Yeah, we actually saw prices tumbling by the most that they have since the days of the Great Depression. I talked today to Mike Schenck. He's the chief economist at the Credit Union National Association, and he is one of a growing number of economists who are really starting to worry about the opposite of inflation now, deflation, and he says that can feed on itself.
Once the general level of prices starts to go down and it becomes obvious that there's general weakness in prices, people tend to put off their purchases because prices will be lower in the future.
But if you look closely at these numbers, we're really talking about food and energy prices that have gone down so drastically, and those are volatile. You get to the core consumer number, it was actually steady, right?
That's true, but it's all relative, Tess. Schenck told us he's still worried that this trend reflects a pullback in recent months.
The Fed's job is not to look at the last year. It's to sort of think about what might happen 12 months from now and how they might circumvent some of the nastiness that appears to be on the horizon.
Which explains why the Fed took this bold step today, and that gives some experts hope that we can head off a declining price spiral. Here's what economist John Lonsky told us at Moody's Investor Service.
I'm skeptical about the threat of deflation, mostly because the Federal Reserve and federal government are currently doing whatever is necessary to reinvigorate a now sinking U.S. economy. And as a result, price deflation fears will disappear quite rapidly.
In other words, Tess, cut the rates and cross your fingers.
I got them crossed. Marketplace's Bob Moon, senior business correspondent. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tess.
Bob mentioned the market's approval of the Fed's move today, and indeed the Dow jumped more than 4%. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Layoff announcements are coming fast and furious these days. This week, the book publisher Macmillan said it would cut 4% of its workforce, 64 jobs. The Massachusetts Turnpike Authority is letting 20 toll collectors go. Best Buy is offering buyouts to all of its corporate headquarter employees. One of the hardest hit industries is a natural casualty of the housing bust, construction. The Commerce Department says new home building fell in November by almost 20%. I spoke earlier today with someone who's experiencing those numbers in real time. Keith Knowles runs a construction and solar installation company in Oregon. I asked him how business is faring.
It's been a challenge this year. We've been through a couple rounds of layoffs and have been scrambling to keep it all together.
How many people did you have to lay off?
We've laid off 6 people over the last year.
And what percentage of your staff is that?
Pretty much almost all of them.
Almost all of them.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we're, like I said, we're a small company, so my father and I run the company, and we're back behind swinging a hammer and running the saw to keep things going.
Can you describe what it's been like to actually have to go through the process of laying people off?
I have been laid off twice in my previous career in marketing and advertising, so I know what it's like to be sitting on that side of the table. My goal has always been to try and give people great work in this industry and well-paying jobs and health insurance and vacation. And so it's hard to know that you're having to let somebody go who maybe just had a baby or has a family.
What do you think is worse, being fired or being the one who is doing the firing?
I think it's the one doing the firing. In being laid off, I suppose there's a sense of freedom to be able to then go explore something new or do something different, but we're letting people go into an economy where unemployment's continuing to rise and it's getting harder and harder for people to find jobs. So for that reason, it's, I think, for me, it's been really hard to have to let people go.
Do you have any sense of how long it might take before you can build up your staff again?
I'm not really sure what 2009 holds yet. We're still trying to figure out what kind of work we're going to have, how it's going to go. We're hoping that with the expansion of the federal tax credits for renewable energy, that will help incent some additional solar projects. And so I'm thinking if we can make it through the winter and get into the spring, we might start to see a rebound next spring.
Well, Keith Knowles of Robert Knowles Construction Company in Newburgh, Oregon, thanks much for your time and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
As if all the layoff announcements weren't enough, those employees left to do all the work will likely receive lower pay raises than in years past. That's according to a survey of 640 large employers by HR management company Hewitt Associates. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports merit raises will be the lowest in more than 30 years, assuming you get one at all.
Back in July, these companies were projecting wage increases of almost 4%. Now that's down to just 3%. More than 1 in 10 workers won't get any raise at all. Ken Abosch runs Hewitt's compensation practice. He says a lot of people have already been taken off the books. Now it's time to trim pay.
A lot of companies feel like they've already been there and have done as much cutting as they can afford right now in terms of headcount. And what they'd rather do, actually, is to hold on to the talent as best they can and to manage their costs by reducing these salary increases instead.
Now, you might think employers would take this opportunity to cut back on employee benefits like health insurance as well as salaries. Turns out it's not so easy. Premiums, deductibles, and the like were set way back in the spring. But when new plans are negotiated for 2010, the rise in out-of-pocket costs like copays and deductibles will continue, says Paul Fronston of the Employee Benefit Research Institute.
Especially among workers in small businesses, we're now getting to the point where a $1,000 deductible is becoming common.
Fronston says premiums will also keep rising for employers and employees. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Yesterday, we brought you a story about Hungary's woes as part of the fallout from the financial crisis. It's had to be bailed out by the IMF and, in turn, is bailing out its banking system. Today, we look at a success story from the same region, Slovakia. In 3 weeks, the country joins the inner circle of European states and adopts the euro. Slovakia was once considered the Czech Republic's poor relation, the former communist country that was least likely to succeed. From the Slovak capital, Bratislava, Stephen Beard reports.
Getting off the train at Bratislava is a letdown. The station is drab and dirty. The city seems dull, even backward. Nothing like the glorious Czech capital, Prague. But when it comes to the economy, it's a different matter.
Slovakia was reformed some years ago. We have excellent tax system and quite good macroeconomic stability.
Peter Kitchener, a spokesman for Slovakian industry, says the budget deficit, national debt and inflation are all under control. That's why Slovakia has been invited to adopt the euro. As this TV ad reminds viewers, in 3 weeks, Slovakia becomes the 16th member of the eurozone. Euro membership is a badge of success. It shows how far this country has come since the end of communism and since Slovakia separated from the Czech Republic in 1993. That led to the collapse of many heavy industries here. Unemployment hit 20%. Analyst Radovan Durana says the country was finally shaken out of its torpor.
The Slovak economy recorded a slowdown, which woke up the people in the country, and now they understand that it's up to them what's happening in the country.
Slovakia cut its taxes, privatized state-run companies, made it easier to hire and fire workers, and attracted more than $18 billion worth of foreign investment. Volkswagen built this state-of-the-art car plant just outside the capital. Peugeot and Kia are here too. This country is now a major auto and machinery and steel manufacturer. Financial journalist Anka Dragu says Slovakia is in better shape than most of the Western economies it's been emulating.
Banking system is solid and there are no defaults on mortgages like you see in other countries.
America inspired the country's free market reforms. But, says Anka, Slovakians haven't followed the example of many Americans digging themselves into debt.
While in the USA people get in their mail the offers of, 10, 12 credit cards and they use one credit card to cover the other one. While in Slovakia they receive from the bank a credit card and people return it to the bank because they don't want to use a credit card. So people are very keen on controlling their finances and not getting into debt.
It's hardly surprising that such a paragon of economic virtue qualified easily to join the eurozone. Impending membership has helped the country weather the global financial storm. The might of the European Central Bank has protected the Slovakian currency from speculators. But some Slovaks still have doubts about adopting the euro. In this open-air vegetable market, some of the shoppers are worried about the downside. This man says prices will go up. It could make the economic crisis even worse. Others complain about loss of sovereignty, only a decade and a half after the country gained independence. Analyst Radovan Durana says Slovakia will lose control over its economy.
When they set the interest rate in Frankfurt, they will be more interested what's happening in France and Germany rather than a small country like Slovakia.
Nevertheless, living in a small country on the edge of Europe with the global downturn gathering pace, most Slovaks feel they'll be better off inside the Eurozone. In Bratislava, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, buying green gifts for the holidays.
They're undoubtedly a discretionary purchase, but I think for plenty of people, they see a responsibility in doing their best to minimize their impact on the planet.
But first, let's do the numbers. That steep cut in the Fed funds rate sent Wall Street a-dancing today. The Dow leapt 4.2%, 359 points to close at 8,924. The Nasdaq bounced up 5.4%, 81 points to finish at 1589. The S&P 500 vaulted 5.1%, 44 points to end the day at 913. Financials jumped on the news. Goldman Sachs gained more than 14%, even though it announced its first ever loss as a public company. Analysts said traders had already priced that loss in. J.P. Morgan Chase rose nearly 13%, and Citigroup cranked up 11%. Airlines took off as well. United rose 7%. Continental gained almost 5%. Boeing bounced up 8%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 2.7%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, explainers, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department releases its quarterly current account trade deficit. The Energy Information Administration gives updated projections of U.S. energy supply and demand to the year 2030. And on December 17, 1944, Public Proclamation No. 21 was issued. It declared that Japanese Americans interned during World War II could go home. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. The list of prominent investors engulfed in the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme just keeps growing. Today, Massachusetts Mutual Life Insurance Company said it lost almost $10 million through one of its subsidiaries. Some charities and individual investors have been completely wiped out by the alleged fraud. Many of the victims were connected to Madoff through posh country clubs in Florida and New York. And as Marketplace's Amy Scott tells us, it's a common way of doing business on Wall Street.
Like many other fund managers, Madoff found investors on the golf course or at the black tie charity ball. Alan Davidson runs investment firm Zeus Securities on Long Island and knows the Madoff family. He says when people see their peers making a lot of money, they want in.
So they say to their friend who they're playing golf with, "Where's your money?" "Oh, I'm doing real well. I'm with, you know, Bernie Madoff, and I'm getting this 18% return." They said, "Well, how do I get into that?"
Thus, Bernie Madoff managed to attract investors from Southampton, New York, to Palm Beach, Florida, a place attorney Adam Donner calls investors' paradise for all the wealthy retirees.
It's like there's a gas station in most cities of America, you know, on all four corners. There's like a brokerage house on all four corners.
Donner represents investors who lost money with Madoff. He says Wall Street is full of charming salespeople selling trust.
I've been doing securities arbitrations for 20 years, and all I ever hear from all my clients, and they can be people of limited means, was the broker was so nice. He's such a nice guy. I can't believe this has happened to me.
But Madoff was more than a nice guy. He was the former chairman of the NASDAQ, securities lawyer Jake Zemanski.
One of the lessons we've learned is just because somebody's prominent and you see them in a social setting, or even we've had a number of Ponzi schemes where there's affinity or religious affiliations, you need to do your due diligence.
Zemanski says the other lesson from Madoff's demise, if you can't figure out how your fund manager is making money, it's probably a good idea to get out. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The reach of the Madoff scandal is so vast that today the FBI set up a special hotline for investors who think they're among the victims. The agency may want to keep that line open even after the dust settles, because history teaches us that it probably won't be the last scam of this economic cycle. There's a name for the part of the cycle we're in. It's called the bezel. Richard Parker of Harvard's Kennedy School knows all about it. Professor Parker, good to have you with us.
Delighted to be here.
So tell us, what is the bezel?
The bezel is a term that was coined by the American economist John Kenneth Galbraith in a book called The Great Crash, 1929, which he wrote in the middle of the 1950s. What he recognized was that at any given time, there is a certain amount of embezzlement going on in the economy. Now, that this falsely inflates the sense of the total wealth of the economy at that moment, because not only does the embezzler now have substantial resources under his control, but the embezzled does not yet know that he or she has lost those resources. And so there's, in effect, a kind of double counting of wealth of both the victim and the victimizer. And the inventory of that duplicity is what Ken called the bezel.
And at another point in time, then, all of that comes to light, is discovered?
Yeah, what happens is that the bezel varies in size with the business cycle and with the financial cycle. And so what we've had in the last few years, presumably, is a run-up in the bezel in conjunction with the run-up in the value of the markets, so that more and more people were drawn into the markets, money was being made, more and more people came in, threw more money at the market. And as long as the markets kept rising and a new round of investors kept coming in, older investors kept getting good returns on their money and spreading the news that this was a great, sound, and high-returning investment.
So how does Bernie Madoff fit into the bezel, and is particularly within the context of the entire financial crisis?
Bernie Madoff is a representative of the species of the bezzler, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And he's by no means unique. This pattern of behavior can be traced back to the famous South Sea Bubble or the Dutch tulip mania. It was a prominent feature in the crash of 1929 and is always present in the run-up in these financial cycles. And then as the top of the market is reached and we tip over and start sliding downward, of course, new money stops coming in and the game is over.
So now that we've entered this bezel phase, is it safe to assume that there are more Madoffs out there?
Oh, I think it's very safe to assume that there are more Madoffs out there.
Will they be as bad? $50 billion worth?
Oh, I think they could be much worse. I mean, again, what you have to remember is that once one or two of these start to tip over, confidence in the market slips, more people begin to pull their money out of various investment vehicles in a rush to get to the door and put it in CDs or cash or whatever. So we're very likely to see many more of these and larger ones as well, too. I mean, we just don't know what's out there. That is a dark and scary forest to go wandering in 2009.
Richard Parker is a senior fellow at Harvard's Shorenstein Center and the author of John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess. I really enjoyed it.
Believe it or not, this holiday season, there are some travel bargains to be had. Airfares are down, and gas, of course, is far more affordable than it was during the summer travel season. But fewer people are driving or flying. The Air Transport Association says airline travel is down 9% from last year. And the U.S. Department of Transportation says Americans drove 100 billion fewer miles this year than last. We wondered if that meant fewer people might be concerned about their carbon emissions. Marketplace's Joellen Easton reports.
I like to give meaningful Christmas gifts that don't break my piggy bank. This year, I'm thinking about giving carbon offsets. That's where I invest in offsetting my friends' and family's greenhouse gas emissions. My investment goes into things like building new wind power or planting trees. But I can't quite commit. Maybe people won't appreciate it. Can I afford it right now? Is it just me, or are others holding back too?
You know, I didn't think anyone is having a fun time retailing in the holidays at the moment.
That's Pete Davies, general manager of TerraPass, a website that sells offsets. He says he gets that people are feeling squeezed, and offsets aren't exactly a necessity.
They're undoubtedly a discretionary purchase, but I think for plenty of people, they see a responsibility in doing their best to minimize their impact on the planet.
And the number of people and businesses who feel that responsibility is growing. In 2006, the voluntary carbon offset market in the U.S. was $97 million. In 2007, the offset market tripled. Eric Carlson heads CarbonFund.org, a nonprofit that sells carbon offsets.
The industry is clearly growing, and awareness about climate change is growing. People want to do something about it, and this is a priority for them.
But 2008 is a recession year, and despite getting more customers, Carlson is seeing the size of individual purchases decrease. So are purchases by businesses. Those make up a much larger portion of the overall market. Some of CarbonFund.org's business partners are now getting their customers to buy offsets while they make their purchase online. That way, customers help businesses offset their emissions instead of having businesses do it all themselves. CarbonFund.org's Carlson says individual purchases normally spike in December. But this year, he's watching the numbers closely. Sales dropped off in the fall when the stock market crashed, so companies like his are offering new options for holiday shoppers. Here's Pete Davies from TerraPass.
Of all the gifts that we sell, the best-selling thing so far this holiday, a smart strip. It's like, it's really the most unglamorous present you can possibly think of.
The smart strip is a power strip that turns off related appliances when you turn off the main appliance. So, for example, it cuts the power to your DVD player when you turn off the television. And the hottest selling item on CarbonFund.org right now is a similarly unglamorous $10 one-ton offset gift card. That's almost enough to offset a single round-trip direct flight from Phoenix to Atlanta. Now, I have three family members flying into Los Angeles for Christmas. What if I offset the carbon generated by their flights? Taken all together, that's 16,000 miles, which is 8 tons of carbon, for a grand total of $80. That's still a little more than I wanted to spend, but I bet those $10 one-ton offset cards would make great stocking stuffers. I'm Joellen Easton for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, a couple of weeks ago, Harvard University reported an $8 billion loss in its endowment. Today, it was Yale's turn. The school says its endowment dropped 25% in recent months, an almost $6 billion loss. Yale President Richard Levin said the university will tamp down on salary growth and take other steps to rein in costs, but it has no plans to change the improvements to its financial aid program that were announced last year. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 359 points, 0.2%. The Nasdaq gained 81 points, 5.4%. And the S&P 500 rose 44 points, 5.1%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time on the program, building a stolen life in America.
You know, there's a lot of people, they make documents and we buy them, and that's the only way you can work. I mean, it's not legal, but what can you do?
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.